Hi, and welcome to another episode of The Lawdown. It's our December episode, so Merry Christmas, I guess. We have our usual stories to discuss today, not necessarily festive, but my name is Wani Sander. I am a senior associate at CM Murray, and I'm joined today by my wonderful colleague, Emma Bartlett, who is a partner at the firm. And we are going to dive straight into our non-Christmassy stories for you today and our take on those. The first story is going to cover Justine Delaney, who is a teenage girl that went to court to play ice hockey with boys. That's the sort of headline. Sounds interesting. We're also going to speak about Benjamin Mendy, the footballer who's suing his old club Man City over unpaid wages. We're going to discuss Philip Schofield's refusal to cooperate with the ITV inquiry, which we also discussed earlier in the year on another episode when this first happened, and the Tesla whistleblower. So, without further ado, Emma, do you want to jump into the Justine Blaney story?
I will. Thank you, Wanu. And I have just realised that, as you said, that these are not Christmassy stories. They are really good stories. So I think it's helpful that we're talking about them, and I'm keen to do so with you. The Justine Blaney story is actually a historical story about a teenager in Toronto in the 80s who was told she couldn't play ice hockey with the boys because she was a girl. And the reason why I wanted to discuss this today was because I just felt that this was really demonstrative of what sex discrimination is about. And it's quite an inspirational story. So maybe that's appropriate for a Christmas episode of the Lawdown. But essentially, it was a gender equality case that was taken all the way to the Supreme Court. It started in the mid-1980s in Canada. Was started by a teenager, Justine Blaney, who was a really good ice skater, but she was finding it a bit boring playing the gender stereotypical sports and wanted to play ice hockey with her brother, which she did. She went along and played with him. She really enjoyed it. She was fast. Said she didn't have much skill on the stick, but that actually made her really good in defence. Girls could play ice hockey in their own team. They weren't allowed to mix the teams, but the rules for girls' ice hockey was different from boys' ice hockey. Girls weren't allowed to body slam, for example, and they were playing in different leagues. And she liked the rougher, faster paced hockey that was played by the boys. And even though she earned a place on the same team that her brother played for, she was ultimately told, well, you're good enough, but we could take you, but we can't because you're a girl. So her and her mum challenged it by going to the local newspaper actually and saying, is there anybody who can help me mount her? And it was, this is a real Goliath story here where she's saying, I need to challenge the Ontario Human Rights Code. And there was a particular aspect to that code which said that from a sex discrimination point of view, you just can't tell someone that they can't do something because of their sex. So squarely gender discrimination. But there was one sort of sub category of the code, code 19, which said that boys and girls could be kept separate in sport. And so that was the provision which they were looking to strike down. As she found a lawyer who was actually one of the first female partners in a law firm in Toronto at the time, and it fitted quite nicely with her own journey into the law. So they took it on. And the reason why the Ontario Hockey Association were trying to justify keeping girls and boys separate was, firstly, they are too physically different to play together. Secondly, girls can play, but in their own league, with their own rules. And then thirdly, mixed teams are no good because it will result in talent leaving if they have to play. So basically, if the boys have to play with the girls, the boys will leave. Which, on the face of it, maybe you could see that some people could give that some credibility. Of course, girls and boys are physically different, but not always. And in this case, Justine was taller and faster than a lot of the boys that she was on the team with at that age. She was, 12 when this started. And you can see actually the physical difference between them at that age. She might actually have the advantage. The thing about if you have mixed teams, we'll lose talent is something that resonates with what we hear in professionals sector from time to time. If we become too diverse, people aren't going to want to be here. They want to be able to do this business fast and move on with it. Ultimately, you'll be pleased to know, and I'm surprised to know, Justine won. She was the court found against her in the first instance, and then she won on appeal. The Ontario Hockey Association appealed. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, who found in her favour. Some of the other things that were said about why girls can't go on the ice and play the same sport as boys were pretty offensive, particularly for Justine as a teenager. They were saying, we haven't got any tampons, you can't play on the ice. The boys' kit is doesn't have the right breast protection, and those sort of comments, which were highly embarrassing for her, as you can imagine, as a teenage girl. But even as a woman, that would be embarrassing for somebody to say you can't do it because you menstruate. It's offensive in all respects. Unfortunately, her victory was a little bit bittersweet because she managed to get onto the team that had originally said, you're good enough to play for us, but we've given your spot to somebody else. Her brother said, do you know what? You have my spot, you go and play. And then when she actually finally went on the ice, it was a mixture of people cheering her and then people booing her. And if she got past a boy, you could hear the crowd shouting at her, at the boys, for letting the girl get past her. So it was sort of, that playground bullying continued. But nevertheless, it's the sort of thing that you see play out in business from time to time, where a woman is succeeding in what might be perceived to be a man's world. And so I thought the story was interesting from that perspective because it's really basic when you look at it from a boys and girls wanting to play ice hockey together or not, as the case may be. And then actually this mirrors what we see in practice in the working world. So I just felt it was really important. The upshot is this all happened in the 80s. Obviously now the leagues of ice hockey for men and women, boys and girls in Canada are huge and both equally competitive. So it just shows that she did the right thing to do the fight. She suffered a lot at the time, but she's changed it for the greater good. It links quite nicely with your whistleblower story, which we'll not come to next, but we'll come to later on.
Yeah, that was a really interesting one, Emma. Thank you. Yeah, I'm just pleased to a degree. I mean, I think we do have a long way to go, as you identified the mirroring challenges that some people still have in the workplace with that bullying approach to highlighting differences that don't really impact the job between men and women. But it's great that she took that case on, or they took that case on, and were able to make, I guess, what was quite a landmark change for the time. So, yeah, some Christmas cheer. Also, lovely little, like, little tidbit about her brother, allowing her to come play with him. That's some good family kind of cheer. Okay, so the next story is Benjamin Mendy, who we covered earlier, I think, in a previous Lowdown. When he had a criminal case brought against him for charges of rape and sexual assault, he was found not guilty on all counts of those charges earlier this year. He has recently filed a claim with the Employment Tribunal for unlawful deduction of wages in relation to pay that he says he is owed. From the period of, I think, September 2021 up until the end of his contract, which ended in June of this year, 2023. Manchester City FC, his club at the time, had failed to pay those wages to him because I think of the fact that he was being charged with those offences. What I have to say is that we do not know the details of his contract. So for me, the interest of the story is more how it might parallel with a similar situation in a normal employer situation. Often, well, not often, but when it does happen, when someone has a criminal case against them, has criminal allegations, the employer might be concerned about how that might impact their work. It might be connected to their work, it might not be. And in circumstances where it's possible, an employer might decide to suspend an employee whilst a criminal case is ongoing, if they think that there's some sort of risk to the business, or if they're, and in order to aid them in any investigations and any disciplinary proceedings. If someone's being suspended, though, it's usually done on full pay. And so if they're not being paid because they've been suspended, they may have a claim for unauthorized deduction from wages where the employer has failed to pay them for that period of time. However, there might be a slight difference where someone is actually unable and unwilling or unable to work and they are on unauthorized leave. So this might happen where somebody's actually in custody and they actually cannot attend the workplace. And in that case, the employer might have justifiable reason not to pay wages. Or, for example, if someone is striking unlawfully, the employer might have a reason not to pay wages. Usually it's in quite exceptional circumstances. Either the employer would need to have some sort of contractual right not to pay the employee, and that's usually kind of set out in an employment contract if there's some sort of exception. Or there's some other sort of exceptional reasons that are set down in legislation. In this case, it's not quite clear what happened, why they decided not to pay him. As I said, we've not seen the contract, but I think in for normal employers, they would probably want to be quite careful prior to suspending pay until they can find out for sure that they have a right to withhold payment. Otherwise, they could find themselves on the end of a claim like this. I thought it was just interesting because I think a lot of people might have assumptions about what an employer's obligations are in situations like this, and it's not always a straightforward that because somebody is has been charged with a criminal offence that they can stop being paid by their employer. It does depend on the circumstances. So, yeah, that's that story.
Yeah, it's always going to be in exceptional circumstances only that employers will be permitted to withhold wages for an employee during the course of their employment because the obligation to pay wages is such a fundamental term of the contract that if the employer withholds wages, then they're going to be in breach and that could give rise to constructive dismissal. Although clearly in this case, the value of the unpaid wages is going to vastly exceed any constructive dismissal compensation for sure.
Yeah, it definitely would be. I'm pretty sure in the same story I read that Mendy was the Premier League's most expensive defender when City paid £52 million for him in 2017. So our next story is about Philip Schofield from ITV and his refusal to cooperate with the inquiry into his conduct. So do you want to take that away, Emma.
Yeah, definitely. As you mentioned, we touched on the story of Philip Schofield earlier this year when he stepped down from his daytime TV role, where he co-hosted, was it This Morning with Holly Willoughby? And it was in the light of it coming, being disclosed that he'd had an affair with a junior colleague in the workplace. And the issue was that he lied about the affair. So he'd been asked about it and he said no. And then obviously it came out subsequently that there was an affair. The ITV obviously launched an investigation. Philip Schofield had left. And at the outset, his lawyer had confirmed that Philip would cooperate with the inquiry. The investigation was undertaken by Jane McCaughey Casey, a very experienced investigator. And it transcribes that Philip and the unnamed individual with whom he'd had the affair, who has also, I understand, left the programme, neither of them in the event cooperated with the investigation, which is actually something which has cropped up a few times in investigations where you have somebody whose evidence is going to be so fundamental to getting to the truth of what's happened is refusing to cooperate. And you and I were talking about the basis on which that this can be reasonable to do so. So in Philip Schofield's case, he obviously was no longer part of ITV. He wasn't part an employee at the relevant time that he was being asked to cooperate with the investigation. And the information provided to the press is that he has mental health concerns, and cooperating with the investigation could cause him mental health damage. So firstly, we have to look at the fact that he's not an employee, so there's no implied obligation on him to cooperate with what might otherwise be a reasonable request of the employer to speak to the investigator. So there's no implied right. Even if there was an implied right or an express right, so if he'd left, and honestly have no idea if he left under a negotiated severance agreement at all. Quite often you will see in settlement agreements a term requiring the individual to cooperate with any internal or external investigation or regulatory matter of which they might have knowledge. So even if there was an express right that they could rely on to require him to cooperate with the investigation, the employer still has to pay attention to the information that he's providing to them, that he can't do it because of serious concerns about his mental well-being. And I did watch the interviews with Philip Schofield post his departure from ITV, in which he was very candid about how his mental health had a severe impact following this his exit from the programme and the all of the news around it. But even without your employee sort of going to the press and saying, "Look how unwell I am," the employer at face value has to accept that the employee is unwell. If the individual was still in the workplace, the employer would need to, if they really wanted the individual to comply with the investigation, would need to potentially get medical evidence to see if there was any way in which they could cooperate. If somebody's mental well-being was so seriously impacted by this, then you can see that perhaps in Philip Schofield's case, it was reasonable for his medical advisors to say he cannot do it. And I'm sure that he didn't actually have to provide any medical evidence to the investigator in order to avoid cooperating with the investigation because he was no longer employed at the time. But if that he was still employed at the time, that's the route that the employer would probably want to go down. And the same with I don't know the reason why the second person wasn't part of the investigation, other than perhaps they just moved on with their lives and didn't want to cooperate with it. But you can see how that could result in an unbalanced investigation report where the main people are unable to be investigated, then you're left with all the circumstantial evidence, can make it quite difficult to produce a report that's effective. Has the employer substantiated its obligation to take seriously allegations and investigate? Because it's not just the allegations into Philip, it was the allegations into did the environment support this type of behaviour and create a toxic environment? They were looking at the culture of the workplace as well. Well, that's something that you can possibly look at without the two main individuals not being participating in the investigation report. But I just thought that was quite useful to have a quick chat about.
Yeah, I agree. Usually when you have sort of investigations in the limelight like this, you can see how the pressure on the individuals that are involved are even greater. So you can see how mental health issues and well-being can come into play. And I think correctly, as you say, if it was happening whilst someone was still an employee, and they could be under the similar type of pressure, maybe not with the same kind of exposure to the public, but similar type of pressure depending on what the allegations are against them, you know, how they feel about it. An employer may just want that medical advice from an occupational health therapist or from their own doctor, from the employee's own doctor, to determine the extent of any impact on them. But also, I think, as you've mentioned, sometimes there are reasonable adjustments or some sort of adjustments that could be made that could assist the person in being able to cooperate and take part. So for some people, and obviously it was all subject to medical advice, but it might be the thought of being alone in front of their employer and having to answer questions. And maybe an adjustment might be allowing them to come with a family member or a friend who can be a support for them. And that might not be something that's part and parcel of the employer's policy, but something that they may want to consider in conjunction with medical advice if that's going to help the individual to take part. There are, you know, a swathe of other things that can be considered, but it can be difficult, I guess, when an employer is trying to get the primary facts from somebody who is not able to cooperate, not able to take part because of their mental health and their general well-being. So there are ways to think about that might assist in that. So our next and final story is in relation to the Tesla whistleblower. So this is a story I saw, I think probably last week now. It's about the Tesla employee, former Tesla employee, his name is Lukas Krupski, who had leaked data, including customer complaints about Tesla's braking and self-driving software. Just as an aside, I think for the very first time I got into a Tesla the other day in an Uber, I was like, oh, it's an interesting car on the inside. So he had raised concerns to a German newspaper called Handelsblatt back in May. He basically said that he'd been concerned about things like the way that AI was being used by Tesla, including their autopilot feature, which includes things like assisted steering and parking. Apparently, it still requires someone to be in the driver's seat. He said he didn't think that the hardware was ready or the software was ready. And he was concerned because he thought it affected, well, for the people that are driving and also for other road users, people on the road, because essentially the cars he was saying are basically experiments on public roads. So even if you don't have a Tesla, you still have children that are walking on footpaths who could be affected by a defective autopilot feature. He also said that he'd found evidence in company data which suggested that requirements relating to the safe operation of vehicles that had a certain level of autonomous or assisted driving technology had not been followed. He added that Tesla employees had spoken to him about vehicles randomly braking in response to non-existent obstacles, which is apparently known in the industry as phantom braking. I mean, even just kind of saying that out loud sounds kind of scary. You know, you don't want that happening in the middle of the road when goodness knows what else is going on around you. So I thought this was an interesting story for two reasons. In the story reports, Mr. Krupski mentions that he felt he had to share this data with the newspaper and kind of go wider than Tesla because he felt that Tesla were not dealing with his concerns internally and that he was being ignored. And the second point was around the impact that he described about being a whistleblower on him. He had said that the last 6 months after he'd whistleblown had been terrifying. He says that he barely slept some nights from the impact of it on his well-being. And I also wanted to touch a little bit on that. So firstly, so the bit about him whistleblowing to the media because Tesla, he felt, were ignoring his complaints or his concerns, sorry, internally. And I just wanted to discuss that the way that the whistleblowing regime works. Ordinarily, you can whistleblow about a number of matters that could be potential cause for concern. So there's a whole list of things. It's things like criminal offence. There's a breach of a legal obligation. If there's been a miscarriage of justice, there's a concern about the health and safety of somebody, and if there's any damage to the environment, or if you've got any concerns that somebody's trying to cover up the information that information about any of those issues, an employee can whistleblow about that. In order to whistleblow, the employee has to be whistleblowing in the public interest, and there is a specific test that has to be met. And ordinarily, when an employee is whistleblowing, they are doing so internally to their employer. That is usually our advice about your first port of call if you're whistleblowing, because there are higher, more stringent standards, requirements if you want to blow externally. To the media, to external bodies. So I kind of wanted to highlight that as the first point, which is that it seemed that he had tried to go down that route but was unsuccessful because the employer didn't respond appropriately. Ordinarily, most employers should have a policy, a whistleblowing policy, in which they're able to receive any whistleblowing concerns, and deal with it appropriately, investigate, if necessary, remediate. And whereby the individual themselves is kept informed and felt that, and they have a feeling that it's all being dealt with appropriately. If an employee whistleblows in that way, they also are protected by whistleblowing legislation. Of course, they have to meet the requirements and I would say the technical requirements. So often it's worthwhile actually getting specific advice in those circumstances if someone feels that they have something to whistleblow about. And they're concerned about whether or not they've got any legal protection, but the legal protection would usually protect them from any suffering any detriment or from being dismissed as a result of having blown the whistle. And you do not need any length of service in order to have that protection. So it can be quite a good level of protection, but you do have to meet the various tests. Now, what's interesting is that if you want to whistleblow outside of your employer's, to the media, there's a more stringent test. Usually, you have to then, on top of the other things I mentioned, have a reasonable belief that the information disclosed is substantially true. So you might have, as in this case, I think he had access to some data, but he would have to have believed that data disclosed something that's substantially true about his concern. The disclosure can't be made for personal gain, and there must be a reason for making a wider disclosure to the media. So, in his case, for example, it's because the internal disclosures seemingly had failed. He wasn't able to do so successfully and get Tesla to respond. I have to say, I think in the report it does say that Tesla will ask for their response, and they haven't given a response. But I have to say that. And fourthly, they have to. Another kind of additional requirement is that it has to be reasonable to make the disclosure more widely to the media in all the circumstances. So it's a higher level of criteria in order to go to the media. And although those are the cases we tend to see quite often, because those are the ones that are in the public, that's the kind of vast amount of day-to-day whistleblowing happens internally to an employer, and that's the usual route, and that's the way that the legislation was designed so that an employer could remediate and look into the concern. And so the second thing I wanted to talk about was the impact that he described on his mental health and well-being. Whistleblowing, whether internally or externally, can feel like a really kind of heavy responsibility, depending on what you're whistleblowing about and depending on the culture of the employer. Employers should be advised to try and create a culture where people can speak up, an open culture where people do not feel that they are restricted from being able to speak about whatever that they have concerns about. But there are unfortunately some circumstances where people work for employers where that isn't the case. And whistleblowing can have very severe impact on their lives, on their family lives. And if they whistleblow more widely to the media, or in the public, it can have a financial impact on them if they're dismissed. emotional impact, just the sort of level of interest of the public, people who are on either side, who either agree with them or who don't agree with them. And it can be a lot. Often we've seen cases where, and I think Emma, you've got one that you mentioned when we were speaking, where people have, are terribly impacted, and it can become quite a difficult situation. So that's something I just wanted to highlight, because we hear about whistleblowers, we know some of the kind of the big whistleblowing names, but sometimes people don't really focus on how much a lot of these people that might be whistleblowing, how much they might be personally impacted by them just trying to do the right thing. And I think it's just important for us to talk about that and to acknowledge that. Emma, I thought you had a story that you wanted to add about a whistleblower experience that you were aware of.
Yeah, one of the more recent investigations that I've done as the investigator, the individual, the complainant was a whistleblower, and he was complaining about the behaviour of his manager, but not just in relation to himself, but in relation to other vulnerable members of the team. And it had been a sustained campaign of bullying and psychological harassment. The impact on this individual was severe. He ended up having career ill health retirement. He was unable to work, but he also lost his family as a result of it. His marriage broke up, and it had a, not quite as extreme as the Tesla whistleblower, where that chap had to leave the country, for example. But you can see the impact that this has. What it makes me think is where an employer is trying to shape a whistleblower policy. What's the point of the whistleblower policy? Well, the individuals who are doing the work in our business are the ones who actually know what's going on a day-to-day basis. And if they see something that's not right, then we want to know about it. We want them to be able to speak up without fear that they're going to be subject to retaliation, in the knowledge that they're going to be taken seriously. And that if, by the very fact of having spoken up, it makes them feel insecure or unwell, then you need to have a policy in place that supports them. So you need to have those three things. And quite often you see within an employment environment that the whistleblower policy is difficult to access, or the individual feels that their career will come to an end as a result of having done it. So it's these types of cases that we see that come out in the press and that we see in practice just make you think about, is you want people to speak up. You want to make sure that they're going to be able to speak up genuinely if they're doing it in good faith without retaliation. And then think about how to support that person so that if they need some well-being support, or they need somebody to talk to just about to express their concerns about having spoken up, because it is a big thing. You're putting your head above the parapet. Then it's just useful when you're looking to understand how your whistleblower policy can actually work properly in practice.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. A lot of employers might have many policies which are just in a drawer, metaphorically speaking, not just, not dusted off, not actually used in practice. And I think it's important that not only do they have a up-to-date policy, but actually that they are in enforcing it properly, they are applying it properly, that it's transparent in a way. I think that other employees can see that whenever somebody speaks up, it is dealt with by the company, that that person is not retaliated against, that that person is supported. And that all goes to creating the sort of safe environment where people feel that they can speak up. And as you mentioned, it's only helpful to the company discovering things that potentially could be an issue and could be remediated, or you can only improve the company, the business overall. So, but I know it doesn't always happen. Thank you. And that's the end of our December non-Christmas episode. We hope you enjoyed it. If you want to catch any of our other material online, we've got lots of other episodes, previous episodes, as well as articles covering a variety of topics at our website, www.cm-murray.com. So thanks again for listening and bye.
Thanks, Bonnie. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.